families with children over unspecified suspicions about fraud. The administration has tried to use additional financial pressure against Minnesota, but without laying out many details.
KBOO news poet Dan Raphael wonders what U.S. city Trump will invade next.
I've been looking for the right word and decided Renee Good was executed. To instill fear, to stop folks from following ICE around town. And of course, the FBI will do a thorough and unbiased investigation in a case their boss Blondie and her boss Orangey have already decided. At a time when anyone working in the federal government knows to disagree is to be unemployed, if not investigated yourself. Which distraction is your flavor today? Venezuela, Greenland, Iran, Epstein? Donnie keeps rolling the dice and they're loaded. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson saying of the federal government, there was a time we could take them at their word. That time is long past. Their and others' courage needs to be spread about and amplified by our own courage, ready for the opportunity. Meanwhile, the plaque in the Smithsonian by Donnie's picture for his first term no longer mentions his impeachments. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Dave Johnson, Anna Wilcox, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called Unreckoned. Oregon is supposed to provide cash compensation to people sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit. With many still waiting for payments, lawmakers consider revising the program. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. So your new story tackles what happens to Oregonians who are convicted and serve time for a crime but are later exonerated. As the law stands right now, what is supposed to happen in these cases?
So what's supposed to happen? So in 2022, Oregon enacted a law that gave compensation for people who were found to be have served prison sentences or been on post-release supervision. They're supposed to get financial compensation for this time, and it works out to $65,000. For each year somebody was wrongfully imprisoned. And that's on top of $25,000 for each year of post-prison supervision. But what hasn't happened is there's been a lot of red tape in exonerees trying to get this money. There's been a lot of delays from the Department of Justice, which is supposed to manage these claims. And in some cases, the Department of Justice will challenge these claims. Last year, there was an attempt to streamline this process to make sure that people weren't waiting and waiting and waiting to get money that they were entitled to. But the bill didn't pass because it ended up, there would have been some sort of impact on the budget, and it was a very tight budget year. And so the bill ended up languishing in ways and means.
Well, I want to talk about some of the individual examples that you bring up in this story that fit into this landscape, right? You spend a good chunk of the article delving into the story of Santiago Ventura Morales, who was released from Oregon prison in 1991. What can you tell me about mm-hmm. his case?
So his case, I had never heard of him before I started doing this story. This happened a long time ago. And with this whole case, he got ended up getting a lot of media attention. There was even a segment on the Oprah Winfrey Show way back when, and they even interviewed him from prison. A lot of the jurors in his case, they came out and said that there was huge problems with his whole trial. And so what happened with him is, he was a migrant farm worker from Oaxaca, Mexico. His primary language was, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but it's Mixtec, which is an indigenous language. He was a farm worker. There was a party outside of Sandy. There was a brawl. There was another farm worker was stabbed. He was found dead. And eventually police singled out Ventura as a prime suspect. He denied it the whole time that he killed this man. But the police, they proceeded to prosecute him, and he went to trial. And there was some pretty big problems with the trial that emerged during the trial and particularly afterwards. One was that one of the key witnesses changed his testimony in the middle of the trial. And it came out later that one of the detectives on the case talked to him during a lunch recess, and it helped refresh his memory. And it came out that he was intimidated into giving incriminating testimony. And there was problems with other witnesses. And the big problem that really stuck out for me with this case is it later got called the fat theory. So they found this knife on Ventura, and the police and prosecutors said that was the murder weapon. But there was no blood that was found on this knife. There was no traces of blood. And so what the prosecution argued was that when he stabbed the victim and he pulled the knife out, it was wiped clean by the fat on the victim's body. And so that's why there was no blood on the knife.
So that's the case. Obviously, a ton of thorny problems with him actually being convicted. And he was released in 1991. Has Ventura been paid out under this law?
No, he still hasn't been paid out. And his case seems pretty clear cut to me and other people. Even when he was released, there was concern that the prosecution was going to file an appeal, and he'd just get dragged back into court. And the governor at the time, Neil Goldschmidt, took the extraordinary step of giving him a conditional pardon, so that if there was an appeal, he would get a pardon. So, which is pretty extraordinary. Other Oregon governors have apologized to him and have noted his case. It just seems pretty clear cut with all of this, and some of the witnesses, even under deposition during the appeal proceedings, they said that they changed their testimony and that they were strong armed by police. But he still hasn't been compensated, and in fact, the Department of Justice is challenging his claim.
Why are they challenging it?
So it's a little unclear. So the challenge, I looked it up I pulled it up, and it's written in very lawyerly language. It doesn't make any a lot of bold claims, but it just denies that the conviction was false and that there was a lack of evidence. It seems to suggest that there was enough evidence there to convict him, and that he's not. That there's still a question that he was actually innocent from this, that the evidence was strong enough. One of the problems with his case was that his primary language was Mixtec, and it's indigenous language, and he was never given a translator for this language. Instead, he was given a translator for Spanish, but the Department of Justice argues that he was given a translator for Spanish and that was enough. They admit that the problem with the knife, that the not having any blood on it, is a problem. But they seem to suggest that there is enough evidence, even with the problems, that he did commit this, and that there shouldn't be a payout.
Well, with this new system, like you mentioned, there was an attempt in the last legislative session to try to remedy this. Can you tell me a little bit, like, by the numbers, how have these wrongful imprisonment payments actually happened?
According to the numbers that I got from the Department of Justice, there have been so there've been complaints where, you know, somebody's lawyer will go to court and file a complaint saying that they're entitled to this compensation. There's been a total of 47 of these complaints, and just 12 of them have been paid. And just a total of $7.25 million has been paid out in total. So that's just a small fraction of this, that a lot of people are just waiting and waiting for things, for legal ordeals that often happened decades ago. And the original bill from last year was the way it was written was much broader. And the Department of Justice said this is going to end up costing us money. The state said we don't have a whole lot of money to spare. So the bill went nowhere. And so this new bill, it does several things, but it creates these really straightforward categories where if a court has found that a person likely didn't commit the crime, it's just automatic that the person is entitled to compensation, just clears the way. And if the governor has issued someone a pardon to someone based on their innocence, then that just creates, you know, that's a streamline that you're assumed to be eligible for this payment. It also creates, it directs the department to also change to evaluate evidence that somebody might be that somebody might be innocent as well. The bill hasn't been written yet, but these are just the basic concepts of it that are available to the public. So it would do these two categories. What would have these presumptions that they would have these straight shots to getting compensation for someone who's had this pardon or somebody where court has found that they didn't do it or they likely didn't do it. But that leaves out quite a few people where their cases might be a little bit murkier it's not going to be a silver bullet. It's not going to solve everything.
Maybe that relates to my next question here. I wanted to ask, does this apply to people who were convicted by non-unanimous juries? I mean, they're entitled to a retrial, but it wasn't until 2020 that the Supreme Court actually overturned the practice that would allow defendants to be convicted by non-unanimous juries, which was primarily only impacting Louisiana and Oregon, who were still doing that at the time. Do they have a stake in this somewhere?
That is a separate, my understanding is that's a separate issue, that there was that ruling, and there has been, that set up like another appeals process for people who are convicted by non-unanimous juries, and there's been like just this ongoing appeals process is my understanding. So this is, this leaves that out, because that whole thing is, that whole process is kind of messy as well. But the person who's really behind the bill, Janice Perkall, she's with the Forensic Justice Project. She's the main force behind the bill. She represents Santiago Ventura Morales. She's been involved with a lot of this. And she told me that she's been working with the Department of Justice on this issue. And she told me that they have identified just these two categories where it seems really clear cut. Like if the governor gives you a pardon based on innocence or court finds like you didn't commit a crime, there should really be no controversy, and that will hopefully speed up things for these for some individuals.
Where do advocates stand on this issue, and where might we see it go in the future?
So the bill also, it has that portion that deals with the state's compensation for people who are wrongly imprisoned. But the bill also has another provision as well. And this is a much broader issue that's related, and that's bad forensic science. And Oregon, again, there's another bill that would, other states, they have a process for people to be able to challenge their convictions if it was based on some kind of science or some kind of forensic discipline that was later found to be faulty. Oregon tried to pass a bill regarding that to have a similar process, but it also died because it ended up costing money. And so what this bill would do if it passes is it would create a mechanism where somebody who's challenged under three specific discredited forensic disciplines would be able to challenge their conviction in court. It would just create that really straightforward pathway. These three discredited forensic science methods, they're, you know, like widely debunked, and they include a thing called comparative lead analysis, The FBI has said that they are not confident with this method, and they're going to stop using it. And what that is it's basically where a lab will take lead that they traces of lead that they get from a crime scene, and they'll go to somebody's house, and and if they own firearms, they'll look at the ammunition that the person has in their house, and they'll do this comparison, and they'll say the lead from the bullets that this person has in their house matches the lead that was found at the crime scene. And that's been found to just not be a reliable forensic discipline. So it would give people this who've been convicted using this forensic discipline a means of challenging their conviction. There's two others that are in there as well that the bill would cover that would let people issue a challenge if their conviction was based upon this forensic discipline is microscopic hair comparisons, where investigators will find hair at a crime scene and they'll link it to the alleged perpetrator. And that's been found to just not be reliable. It's like there's been times they've found like dog hairs or things that aren't even hairs. And they'll say that these are, this matches the perpetrator and they link it to the crime scene. But that's just also been found to just not be reliable. And the third one is compared to bite mark analysis, where maybe there's the victim bit the perpetrator and they'll take a look at the victim's teeth and they'll match it to the bite mark. And that's also been found to not be reliable. So they're widely debunked. It's widely agreed that they shouldn't be used. But there's still people who, people have been convicted in Oregon using these methods. But right now they don't have a means of challenging their conviction, even considering all this.
Wow. Well, Jake, what are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
I was surprised by a few things in the story. I was surprised that Oregon was so far behind in offering compensation to people who had been wrongfully convicted. I'm sure some readers will recall just during the pandemic and after the George Floyd protests, there was a kind of a reckoning with the criminal justice system. And so I'm kind of surprised that it took so long for these things to come into effect as far as offering compensation, because most states already do this. I was just kind of surprised that the Department of Justice has been so slow in processing these. There's been Democratic attorney generals for, decades now. And I've heard that the current attorney general, Dan Rayfield, has taken a different approach to this, that he's been wants to speed up these claims and wants to improve the process. But I was just kind of surprised that there's been this roadblock for what seems, really clear cut. If you're wrongfully convicted, you should be compensated for, losing years of your life for something you didn't do. I think it's also worth noting that Oregon is, compared to other states, is pretty behind as far as reevaluating forensic science that gets used to convict people. A lot of other states allow for just general challenges if you're convicted using some sort of discredited forensic discipline. But Oregon's, the law hasn't really caught up with the science in Oregon. And that right now we're just considering just a very narrow set of disciplines that could be used to free people after they've been wrongfully convicted.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, what's the best way for them to do that?
They should go find their nearest street roots vendor.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
That was Jake Thomas, reporter from Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story for the paper. It's called Unreckoned. Oregon is supposed to provide cash compensation to people sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit. With many still waiting for payments, lawmakers consider revising the program. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On Tuesday, the Portland City Council's Community and Public Safety Committee heard over an hour of public testimony on a possible ordinance to ban ICE officers from concealing their identities with masks. Testifiers pushed the council to go further. Let's listen.
Thank you, Council. My name is Catherine Jimenez. As we've seen the horrors unfold in Minnesota across the country by DHS's terror campaign, the majority of the nation is now realizing something Portlanders have known since the summer. This is not about public safety. This is about instilling chaos and complicity by fear into the electorate. And we knew this was inevitable. We knew this after witnessing one of our own mothers being dogpiled by agents face first into the mud for wearing a banana suit and playing the clarinet. We knew this would happen after witnessing dozens of attempts of vehicular manslaughter by federal agents peeling out of the McAdam facility, narrowly missing pedestrians. We knew this would happen when the majority of ICE detainments reported in 2025 occurred at places of work, at places of worship, at courthouses, at schools. We knew this would happen coming from the same police department that cost the city over $22 million in settlements alone. We heard multiple times from public briefings last week that community trust in police bureaus is slipping. It's gone. As far as this community has seen, PPB and other bureaus have made it clear who they are protecting. The same masked, untrained, volatile individuals who are desecrating what it means to be a public servant. This policy is the bare minimum for building back community trust and proving us wrong in that matter for public safety offices. And while I could go on to recount the failures of our local law enforcement, that deters from the greater message here, that a mother was shot and killed in the face, dropping her kid off at school. And the guy who did it, this alleged agent, called her an effing bee, real professional in terms of law enforcement. And to honor her legacy, I had a poem that I was wanting to read, but it looks like we're not going to have time for that. Please look up A New National Anthem by Ada Limon, the 24th elected Poet Laureate of the United States. And please remember Keith Porter Jr., Silverio Viejas Gonzalez, and all others who have lost their lives and are still missing due to this evil, hateful agenda. Stand up. Fight for your community. This is what we want. Thank you, Council.
I'm MB, and I'm testifying in support-ish of this ordinance, but you know, let me make this clear. This is the bare minimum, and in no way is this going to be the thing that will save us. And you know, quite frankly, I doubt PPB or the feds will comply with it. The only benefit of this ordinance is the specific information that BPB might collect for reports, and again, that's only if they comply with it. To ensure said information is gathered, I suggest implementing a system for community report PPB officers that don't try to collect data, essentially a tool for community members to hold them accountable. Along with that, like actual punitive repercussions for officers who don't comply with this, you know, what comply with what's being required of them. And, you know, I think we all know, like, PPB has a sordid history of racism, killing and maiming community members, a history that mirrors that of ICE. I hate to make a moral plea to the cops, of all people, but PPB should be jumping at the opportunity to arrest and convict actual criminals, actual vile, murderous scum. And again, I'll wrap this up by once again demanding that the permit to the McAdam facility be revoked. How many more community members have to be disappeared and killed before we stop giving them a home base to operate out of in the city? You want to dismantle ICE brick by brick, then I suggest getting rid of their disgusting fortress they operate out of in here. Like, what do we got, 30 seconds left? All right. Also not really understanding why we're putting the safety of PPB officers over our community members. That's laughable. It's really laughable. You signed up for this job. If PPB is going to do one good thing, well, you know, the police are even still a thing, this might as well be it. That's it.
Hi, my name is Amzai. I'm a resident of St. John's and an organizer with Socialist Alternative, and I want to speak in favor of Councillor Canall's legislation. ICE has escalated from terrorizing communities to outright murder in recent months, and we need every piece of legislation possible to disrupt their operations. Councillors Green and Murillo have spoken in recent months about the need to throw sand in the gears of ICE's operations. I completely agree with that and support this legislation in that spirit. But I think as socialists, we also have to go further, point towards dismantling the whole capitalist machine that turns those gears in the first place. And when it comes to legislation like today, or to further reaching proposals like revoking the McAdam ICE facility permit, which I do want to be on the record in support of, I think we've heard understandable hesitation about that. We've heard about the supremacy clause, the stacked conservative court, the fact that federal forces can just, you know, ignore laws that we pass here. And all of that's true. It's obstacles we have to overcome. I think we have to recognize that the victories against Trump and his administration aren't going to happen in the halls of power. They're going to happen in the streets. They're going to happen with mass workplace action, like a coordinated one-day strike. And yeah, we need to use the legislative process, right, and the resources of elected office to raise people's sights in that direction, to push the envelope, right, even tear it open. Respectfully, yeah, I think go further than brick by brick in the pace we're approaching that. I think, yeah, we need to be raising the confidence of workers, of young people, immigrants, everyone oppressed by capitalism to take matters actually into their own hands, shut down business as usual with mass coordinated action, class struggle, right? That's where the actual power to defeat Trump and get through those legislative obstacles lies. And I think that's actually exactly what dozens of unions, socialist groups, and rapid response networks in Minneapolis have come together and called for just this morning. They're calling for a day without shopping and without work, a one-day strike on January 23rd Minneapolis to shut down ICE. So I think, yeah, we need to take that kind of approach here too, use legislation like Councillor Canall's really relentlessly as a springboard to point in that direction. Thank you. Solidarity.
Hello, my name is Blair Glennon. I am a resident of District 2 and would like to speak in favor of this ordinance. Standing up to people in power is sometimes messy and unpleasant. It doesn't always make powerful friends happy. I spoke up when my former workplace, Legacy Emanuel, was colluding with ICE, and it did not go well. They did not change their policies. I am now a temporarily unemployed and uninsured person. But it's still 100% worth it for all of us to stand up for our community members being targeted by ICE. I want to point out that Portland police are not the victims in this circumstance. They can continue to use weaponized victimization as much as they would like. They are still not the victims. Councillor Zimmerman, hopefully you will look back at public testimony. I read your New Year's newsletter. You spoke as though federal overreach and ICE issues, you spoke about federal overreach and ICE issues as if they were solved. You should be especially concerned about this issue given the ICE facility that is used as a home base to terrorize the entire Portland metropolitan area is in your district. Please push this ordinance forward. Thank you.
Members of the council and the terrified citizens of Portland, we are in the middle of an unstable and dangerous part of our history. People are being ripped from their families, assaulted, kidnapped, and then taken without any accountability or documentation. These federal officers have been allowed to run rampant and destroy innocent people's lives in the name of the government. In public, in plain sight, they hide their faces, refuse to give identification of any kind, and have even started shooting people point blank while being surrounded by cameras. With that, they are still continuing to lie. They're using fear and violence to try to force the public and state and city governments to comply. They are now currently going door to door in Minneapolis after the devastating murder of Renee Nicole Good. Door to door. In what world does that constitute the parameters of Border Patrol? The state and city govs are just standing by and allowing our constitutional rights to erode in front of our very eyes. While I'm glad to see legislation being brought forth of this matter, there is more that needs to be done, and soon. We don't have 18 months to 2 years to implement something as small as uniform and name tag changes, and that's not fast enough. We're asking for more accountability and action from our government. Again, with some of the things, you need to revoke the permit. There is a whole home base here in our city. They are allowed to bring people. They are leaving there in unmarked cars every single day. They're pushing people down. They're tear gassing. I'm a nanny. I work with children. One of the families that I nanny for lives in that apartment building right next to them. They are tear gassing and pepper spraying and all that stuff every single day. They had to move. Like they are destroying the city. This is not safe. We cannot have them here. Please work on revoking the permit. Also, having not requiring officers to detain people impersonating federal, state, or city officers that are currently pretending and with their identities and are using armed forces and fear and intimidation tactics on the public, there's racism prevalent. I don't understand what we're doing. Please take action.
Apologies, but could you state your name for the record?
Oh, Cassidy Kimball.
Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Isabella Shepherd, representing PDXCD and the Coalition for Revoking the ICE Permit. I would like to support this ordinance. I'm not sure if I can. I would like to highlight that this is the first piece of legislation with any teeth regarding enforcement. I have argued before that PPB should be instructed to arrest DHS and ICE because they are not above the law. And this ordinance does say PPB officers will issue commands, restrain, or detain the person claiming to be a law enforcement officer. However, it is followed by, if it is determined that the person is a law enforcement officer acting within the scope of lawful duties, PPB officers shall promptly end any continued detention or restraint and document the circumstances of the encounter. Any commands, restraint, or detention must be limited in scope and duration to what is reasonably necessary to confirm or dispel the officer's reasonable suspicion and to address legitimate safety concerns. In other words, PPB is explicitly prohibited from enforcing the mask ban once it is determined that the person they detain is in fact ICE. It is effectively just another law forbidding impersonating an officer, which is already illegal. I fail to see the purpose of banning federal officers from concealing their identity if you also forbid the police from enforcing the mask ban on federal officers. In a context where ICE has been given the budget equivalent to the 13th largest military in the world, where it has effectively declared war on our communities, where DHS didn't have to arrest anyone at the protest on Thursday because PPB was doing it for them, where a PPB officer stuck a pepper spray can in my face while screaming at me for protesting ICE, and another officer grabbed my breasts, where ICE shot two Portlanders in broad daylight last week, we have to take bold action and not comply in advance. If you were to criminalize ICE concealing their identities, but still allow them to snatch mothers from their homes as long as they show their faces, I would say go for it, but that's still not enough. But this ordinance, which effectively allows them to continue their heinous operations with or without a mask, is just not very useful.
That was some of the public testimony at the Portland City Council Community and Public Safety Committee on Tuesday on the possible ordinance to ban ICE officers from concealing their identities. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
New year, new